I'm going to create more waste because I'm worried some yucko stuck his butter knife in the ketchup before I got there to order my pork roll sandwich.
It's so awesome when one or both of your clients is leaning so far to one side of the boat that one of your oars will not touch the water.
You're doing line class records to try to make a big name for yourself. It's garbage.
I didn't get the stream name. Can you tell me the stream name again?
It's the stream.
Good morning, degenerate anglers. Welcome to Bent, the podcast that thinks your ability to make interesting conversation in the boat and always show up on time matters more than your proficiency with a rod or the size of your tackle box. I'm Joe Cermelli.
I'm Miles Nolte, and amen to that, man. I'll take an interesting fishing buddy over an experienced one every single time.
Right?
Yep.
Right? To be clear, I'm not advocating ignorance. Right. If we've been fishing together for, I don't know, like 5 years and you haven't bothered to learn how to tie on a leader or back up a trailer, then you're just lazy or not actually that interested in fishing. In which case, strong chance I wouldn't be fishing with you for 5 years. Like I would have given up on you a lot sooner than 5 years. But anyway, theoretically, for
the sake of argument, if you haven't figured it out by then.
For the sake of argument, I'm a big sake of the argument guy. Exactly. So I got to say, though, part of what I love about my job I always have is that I've gotten to fish with many different people and get exposed to just tons of different approaches in different places, different rigs and techniques. But the flip side of that diverse fishing experience is that I'm constantly shown how little I actually know. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like I've never been afraid to suck at a particular kind of fishing. So long as at the end of the day, I've learned something, whether it could be a new knot or a new rig, or even just the habits of fish that maybe I don't target very often. So I feel like very well versed in a broad sense, but you get away from what you do, and it's very shocking how little you actually know.
Oh, yeah, and you only figure that out by going and doing new things.
Yep.
Right? Like the most recent example I have is fishing with you for shad. I'd never seen a shad before in my life, and trying to figure out how to work those shad darts and like figure out the current and all the different things that you showed me was a nice moment of realization. Like, I can figure all this stuff out. I can do it, but I don't know it. And had I been dropped there on my own, I wouldn't have been able to. Like, I think one of the things that I have learned, the more fishing I've done in the more places, I've learned that I suck at a lot of kinds of fishing. I'm a pretty good learner, but there are only certain things that I'm truly good at. And I'm hoping that with this particular episode that we've laid out, that we maybe, I don't know, I hope we encourage a few folks to feel comfortable sucking a little bit. Like, I hope by us stepping out and saying, like, hey, we suck at a lot of stuff when it comes to fishing, and that's okay. I hope other people will take a cue and be willing to do that. But I'm slightly hesitant about this week's theme, I gotta say.
Are you really?
A little. Huh. Like, I'm not losing sleep. It's not the main thing that's keeping me up, but truly, and I think you get this, I'm not sure how this one's going to land, right? Because we're this...
Fair. You're right.
Say it. This episode's going to focus on fly fishing, all right? And we talk about fly fishing on the show all the time, but in the past, Joe and I, we've always made a concerted effort to make sure that we talk about something else too. We get some conventional stuff in there. Yep. We get some ice. We've never gone straight fly before.
No, that's true. And I think what Miles is getting at is that we have a pretty broad mix of anglers, right, who listen to this show. And we say all the time that we welcome everyone here at Bent who likes to fish.
Yep.
So long as you're thoughtful and ethical about it. You're not like a dirtbag out there. But we certainly don't want to alienate anybody. But the fly thing, it can be kind of polarizing. We know that some of you are dedicated fly folks. Some of you dabble with fly gear, or at least, you know, you're a little bit interested in it. And some of you are either completely unfamiliar or just outright like anti-fly.
Yeah.
And that's okay. We like all of you. That's totally all okay.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And we hope that at least a couple people will hear this and maybe feel a little differently if perhaps you're on the anti side. But the thing is, it's June. And June, where I live, like all I think about when it comes to June is rivers just boiling with hatching insects. And every fish in every one of those rivers is chowing on those insects.
Yep.
And I have been, you know, when I've been out on the rivers, I have fished dry flies off and on for a few months. But right now, this week is like the beginning of the prime time. So in the spirit of that, We were thinking we might spread a little unapologetic love for floating flies and surface feeding trout because it's fun.
Yeah, and the thing is, we know there's going to be some of you who are understandably skeptical about this, right? I mean, we work at Meat Eater, right? Steve Rinella didn't build his fan base advocating for dainty dry flies and precious trout.
No.
But even Steve will pick up the long rod from time to time and admit how much goddamn fun it is, right? Or can be. Yeah. Even if he's not a huge fan of fly fishing culture.
That is true.
You've seen this, right?
I have seen him do it with my own two eyes. That is all true. But I think before we continue with our attempt at a full-throated appeal for why fly fishing is fun and not necessarily annoying or obnoxious, we do want to remind all of you out there that this show is brought to you by 13 Fishing.
It is, and that's a little awkward.
It's a little awkward. Because
13 doesn't actually make any fly rods, at least not yet.
So not yet. That. they don't yet, but even in the heaviest insect hatch and dry fly fun, I still have an Omen Black casting rod at the ready in my boat, rigged up with a swim bait or a jerk bait. Because here's a little tip. Here's a little tip for everybody out there. While the small and medium-sized fish in the river are distracted because they're stuffing their faces on teeny tiny bugs, sometimes like the really big fish take advantage of the smaller fish being distracted. After I've cast some flies through a pool for a while and had my fun, I'll usually pick up the short stick and huck some kind of a big bait in there a few times just to see if Walter P. Brown Trout or maybe an opportunistic smallmouth or pike is feeling a little frisky. I've had that work out well in the past.
Absolutely. It's a great tip, man. And I may not agree about which hand we reel with on a bait caster. Right, because I'm a righty. I'm a right hand retrieve guy all the way. Right,
it's wrong.
Which it's just wrong. I I've been called out for it recently. People are like, "Why is your handle on the wrong side?" I'm like, "I didn't switch hands yet when the photo was taken." Damn you! I cast right and reel right. I do the switch. But anyway, we do both agree that there's nothing wrong with bringing a conventional rod on a fly fishing trip.
Yeah,
Lord knows I do it all the time.
Me too.
All the time.
Or it go the other way too. There's nothing wrong with bringing a fly rod on a conventional trip. That's fine too. And for those of you out there feeling unsure, we're just trying to give you license to go for it. Give it a shot.
Go for it.
Just try it out. Getting into long rod doesn't have to be intimidating, even though some people make it out that way. It's not that hard. And going fly fishing, it doesn't mean that you like got to wear a tweed jacket with elbow patches or whatever, or like a felt hat, which I think is stupid. And you don't have to extend your pinky while drinking a beverage. You don't have to do any of those things. One last point, fishing a fly rod does not make you any less of a degenerate.
It's true. I do wear the tweed and the felt hat. I choose to do so, but that doesn't mean that you have to. My tweed's actually getting tight. I need bigger tweed. Anyway, that was all true. And it's okay to bring a fly rod and not use it. Or only use it if the situation is right, right?
Yeah.
And I think when I fish saltwater, I rarely go inshore saltwater fishing without a fly rod, but I never go with only fly rods.
Right.
I just don't do that. And if the situation presents itself to get some mahis or stripers on the fly, it's like a total bonus. And I might fly fish all day, but I'm never going out there with just that stuff, right? So anyway, today we've kind of assembled a cast of motley characters, all of whom are both professional fly anglers and exactly the kinds of people you just want to sit around a fire and drink whiskey with.
Absolutely. They're all legitimately interesting, good folks. We're going to start things off with our friend Alvin Dedeau, who we've had on the show many times before. But in case you forgot, Alvin is a former frontman for the Austin-based funk band Bad Mother Goose and the Brothers Grimm, who started working in a fly shop during the day to help pay for his rock star lifestyle. And that led him down the guiding path, which is what he's been doing full time now for decades. Alvin's home water is the Lower Colorado River around Austin, where he just puts a hurting on the largemouth and the Guadalupe bass and the white bass and all kinds of other stuff. I've done it with him. It's super fun. But he also guides for redfish down on the coast, and he spent many, many years chasing trout in the Rockies. So he's well-rounded.
Yep, bottom line, Alvin knows his shit, okay? And today he's here for our Smooth Move segment, where we let guides, outfitters, shop workers, and anyone else who makes a living in the fishing industry tell stories about stupid or hilarious things that clients do. But this one is more instructive than most, I'm going to say.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of times we're just making fun of people, but Alvin actually came with a useful, functional suggestion. Anytime you find yourself fishing out of a small boat, particularly someone else's boat, this is going to help you. And I really enjoyed recording this one. I had a good time. I kind of forgot the mic was even on. We were just bullshitting. If you've ever wondered what fishing guides talk about after everyone leaves, it kind of sounds like this.
Why did you do that? Why? Why did you do that, Karen? Oh my God.
This move doesn't really have a name, but it has a solution. It has there's a cure for this move. And the cure is center up. Get in the middle of the boat. This is one that just anybody that rows a boat,
pulls
a boat, pushes a boat, you got to stay in the middle of the boat. I mean, it's so awesome when one or both of your clients is leaning so far to one side of the boat that one of your oars will not touch the water. You know, you got that one, it's like digging in, and the other one's like catching air because the boat's like on its gunwale. Yeah, so that's a constant one, you know. Like, come on, man. In my jet boat, there's a little logo that's on the bench that I have people stand on, and I've been tempted to actually put some rails or something on either side of the logo and be like, if you feel that rail under your foot, you need to take a step in the opposite direction. But it's a problem.
You could just put down gaffer's tape in like a little, like create a little box, like do not step outside of the gaffer's tape.
I've seriously considered that. I just tell them, look, stay on the logo. Look down every once in a while, make sure you're on the logo.
But see, I can take this a step further, right? Because I don't know how many people I've rode, just happened not too long ago. The dude was perfectly centered because he had no choice because he was in the leg braces on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
But then we'd set up on a dry fly fish and he would cast with so much oomph that like the entire drift boat would be rocking like we were 20 miles offshore. And it's like, dude, I don't understand why you must put so much body energy into laying out a dry fly. Like there's no need for that. You guys have to have dealt with that too. Like, I don't understand it. Just stand and cast. Why?
It's like, dude, I got to get that fly out of there. And if I don't put some body English into it, that thing is not going to make it that 30 feet to the bank.
I know I'm not going to do it with my arm. I got to do it with my legs.
You got to
hammer everything's rattling around. Drinks are coming out of cup holders. Lay down the f-ing atoms, all right?
Oh, dude, I used to have this really skinny one of those Arkansas trout boats. It was like 20 feet long, but it was super skinny.
Oh, and, I've been on them, yeah.
And that thing would rock from side to side. You know, I had this one guy in particular, you know, it was like 5 to 6 false casts per presentation. And each one was just like, you know, it was like he was trying to knock somebody out with these swings. And the boat would just rock from side to side so violently that my back would hurt at the end of the day from like me just trying to overcorrect to keep myself in an upright position.
Well, I had a client for many, many years. He was a really good client and a good guy, but I won't use his real name because I don't have to. I just nicknamed him Captain Morgan because he would ride in the back of my boat with his foot perched up on the gunwale the entire time. Just completely throwing that thing off kilter so that I was almost at a 45 degree angle rowing down the river all day. And I would literally have to say, Captain, bring it back to center for me, buddy, at least 10 times a day. And he always felt back. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. But within 10 minutes, that foot would creep right back up and he'd be right back on the gunnel.
Dude, I've seen it. It's the creep. They can't help it. It's like, you know, guys who know, like you said, the captain knew he was supposed to stay in the center, but it's just like this weird creep thing. It's magnetic. You got to put that foot as far away from the other foot as you can.
So there you have it, everybody. Hot tip from Alvin Dedeau. If you really, really, really want to piss off your guide, just keep rocking your body weight from one side to the other all day long. Alvin, thanks so much, man. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
See, now I really think that's something most casual anglers just don't know about or think about.
I think that's
centering
right.
Centering your weight in small boats makes such a huge difference. And as we've discussed, I own the Mini Cooper of drift boats, as you called it. So having the dude up front centered in my boat in particular is extremely important to me. It's like, it's very important because we might all go in. Okay. It's not just a matter of being tilted. Like we might dump the thing, you know?
It's one of those things, you're right. Casual anglers don't think about because they don't have to. I had no idea about any of that until I was the one driving and rowing boats all the time.
Right.
And because other people's sense of where they're standing has impacted my life so much, right? Like now it's just habit. I always keep an eye on weight and balance when I'm in someone else's boat, especially.
Yeah. It's like one of those unwritten rules of courtesy that people who know notice.
Yeah.
It's just not enough people, unfortunately.
And we're going to keep rolling with this. We're gonna keep the theme here and bring you a fly fishing tackle tip that we also think will be equally helpful. Be forewarned, this one gets a little technical. It's not difficult. This isn't a hard thing to do. It's just kind of specific, so you got to pay attention.
I'm getting hacked.
It's coming from inside the city.
Hack the planet!
So welcome back to Tackle Hacks. Joining us today, our friend and Montana / Washington State guide, Kinsley Scott. Kinsley, how are you today?
I am doing well. How are you guys?
We are great. We're going to be better after this because you are going to pull from your many years of experience guiding, and you're going to give us a tackle hack today, a little tip, something, just a little nugget for anglers to put in their pockets that will make them better on the water. At least that's the plan.
Yes. And this one may not be applicable to all trout anglers, but for us here in Western Montana, our bread and butter are foam dry flies with droppers. That's
right.
Mm-hmm. The majority of our fishing through the entire season, really. So my hack today to improve your dry dropper fishing to make life a lot easier is using a shorter leader. So I run a 7.5-foot leader to my dry fly.
Right.
And right out of the package, I actually chop off about a foot off the butt section of it.
Off the butt section?
Yes. And I'll explain why. So I cut about a foot off of the butt section. So that welded loop that comes on a leader out of the factory, I retie a perfection loop. So now we'll say my leader is down to about 6.5 feet. So it's a pretty chunky taper. What that allows me to do, our fish here in Montana, Western Montana specifically, aren't very line shy, spooky, especially if you're fishing a bigger bug, right? We'll say like salmon fly, golden stone fly season. So with that 6.5-foot dry fly leader, that allows me to then throw a much longer dropper. So say I throw a 4-foot dropper to, you know, I have a salmon fly dry and I want to fish a Pats below and I want 4 feet.
Right.
In total, that would cut my entire leader system down to about 10.5 feet, which is pretty manageable. Whereas if you were to keep that 7.5-foot leader right out of the package with then a 4-foot leader, you're pushing about 12 feet of leader in your cast. So if you can shorten that leader section up, it's still going to overturn your fly, but it's going to really compact things and make it a lot more manageable when casting.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a great tip. That makes a lot of sense. My only critique of that is a lot of the dudes I fly fish with couldn't do that because if they cut the perfection loop off, they wouldn't know how to tie a new one.
Fair. YouTube is great for that.
I was going to say, your phone will teach you in about 45 seconds.
Exactly. Yes.
No, that's a great tip. I wish that I had done that when I was guiding, because it would have probably saved me a lot of tangles that I had to pick apart for the next 45 minutes or so.
Yes.
So next time you're out there throwing big dry droppers, chop off the back end of that leader. See how it works. Let us know how you do. Kinsley, thanks so much, and we'll look forward to another tackle hack from you soon.
Thank you, guys.
See, I told you in a podcast many moons ago, I've been saying all along that all you need to catch fish in Montana is a big-ass chubby. And that was just confirmed.
Western Montana. She clearly...
Oh, is that what it is?
Did you not listen? She clearly specified Western Montana, and she did that on purpose because she grew up on the Missouri where that's not true. And I don't know why, but the trout in Western Montana are dumber. I don't know why that is, but I am going to try this trick out because I haven't had a chance to do it yet. And we're coming to salmon fly and golden stone season any day now, really. So right, I'm going to try this one, but I was thinking about it, and this rigging, this tip that she gave, I think is more broadly applicable than Kinsley realized. I would suggest that this one's useful for people who are curious about fly fishing but don't live in a place with trout streams. So, the rig she was talking about, the big dry fly with the dropper setup, that is sort of a classic out west Rocky Mountain trout setup. I actually use something very similar for panfish and bass on lakes. I've adapted that rig for warm water species, and I think that her leader hack would be perfect for that situation. So here's my version that I suggest you guys try on a lake. Do exactly what Kinsley suggests. Chop that leader to make it a more manageable length. Then to the end of it, tie something big and buoyant. A small popper fly or a diver, maybe a cicada, right?
Hey, maybe. Brutex.
Maybe a cicada. And then tie a 3 to 4 foot section of leader off the bend of the hook, you know, like 4 6-pound test, something like that. And then put any kind of weighted fly that you like on that. I personally, I'm a big fan of prince nymphs or hare's ears because they just look a little bit like everything and they'll work really well on panfish. Or I'll throw on like a woolly bugger if I'm after bass. You pitch that thing up toward a weed line in the lake. You let it settle and then give it short strips with long pauses in between. You'll either get to watch that floating fly get inhaled or more likely, the floating fly will just disappear when a fish eats the bottom fly. So seriously, try that out the next time you're lake fishing in shallow water or along weed lines. I think you'll be impressed with how well it works.
Solid tip, man. And like a blind side for me has always been still water trout on the fly. And I've done very little of that, but I actually got to do it many years ago in Montana on a small lake. And it was the first time I ever threw dries on still water for trout. And dude, it was a blast.
Yep.
I must say, like, it's a totally different game. Yeah, you've done it, so you know what I'm saying. It's like these fish are cruising, so you're just kind of letting your stuff bob around out there and like ride the wake and ride the ripple, and they just come out of nowhere and slurp it. You can't really target them like a head in a river. So much fun, so much fun. But it's a lot of useful information today.
I don't know what's wrong with us.
So I know we have value today, and we're gonna keep that going right now. We're gonna keep our value up as we head into fish news.
Fish news.
That escalated quickly.
So I have one shout out this week before we get going on news, going out to listener Eric Halfman. And this is a response to our last That's My Bar segment where we wax nostalgic about ketchup in glass bottles.
Yep. And Eric totally validated me on this one. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, okay, but I have more to say about it, okay? So we talk about how you don't see that anymore, and in that That's My Bar, I brought up the butter knife trick, where sometimes you start the ketchup in the glass bottle with a butter knife, you stick it in there and get it going, which you said was a childish maneuver.
I said it was a rookie move. I did.
A rookie move, and that's fair. Anyway, Eric wrote in to say, you should never use a butter knife to start ketchup in a glass bottle because according to the servers in a bar near him that also uses glass ketchup bottles, if someone sticks a butter knife in the bottle is now deemed unsanitary and tainted and must be thrown away.
Yep.
Now, I will admit that I, like many of you, probably never considered this, okay? I didn't. And I get it.
I admit I didn't consider that. Like, that is a much stronger argument than my stupid, like, oh, that's for kids. That was his is like a legitimate reason.
Yeah. But I still take issue, right? Now look, it makes I do, and I'll tell you why. It makes perfect sense. I get it. But this also feels to me like one of those things people in the 80s and 90s like gave zero shits about. Like there were smoking sections on airplanes. Children were shooting each other with BB guns instead of Nerf guns, and your dad would help you build the ramp that would allow you to jump the creek on a bike sans helmet. So nobody was worried about a butter knife tainting ketchup. And my point is, while the knife and the ketchup thing isn't wrong, this, I don't know, man, it just feels like a very millennial observation to me. You know what I'm saying? Like there's more important shit to worry about. So really, I guess, Eric, thanks thanks for ruining ketchup in glass bottles, the last bastion of Americana, because now
this is
I
not
can't
Eric's
look,
fault. This is it, not his fault. Slight,
it's like going to the doctor. I don't have cancer if you don't tell me I do. You know what I mean? So now I'll never be able to look at a glass ketchup bottle and go, oh man, like what nasty ass stuck their butter knife in there.
I think you're
so thanks.
I think your anger here is misplaced. I don't think it's Eric's fault. I don't think it's the server's fault. I don't think it's the restaurant's fault. If you want to blame someone, you can blame like the health department for trying to keep you safe. So if that's who you get mad at them.
It's not really Eric's fault. It's just like, I didn't need to know that. And I'm going to be like, excuse me, do you have single serve packets? I'm going to create more trash. I'm going to create more waste because I'm worried some yucko stuck his butter knife in the ketchup before I got there to order my pork roll sandwich. Damn it. Anyway, that's my thanks, shout Eric. Out of the week. You have anything good this week? We move on.
I think we have to talk about the elephant in the playlist.
We're gonna get to that because, as a reminder, this is a competition. Miles and I do not know which news stories the other dude is bringing to the table, and at the end, judgment shall be passed by the mighty Phil, our audio engineer. And what Miles is referring to is that Phil has officially contributed now to the Bent Spotify playlist, which many of you guys seem to be enjoying. We're getting a lot of great notes on that. The numbers are ticking up. You're listening. And if you're not rocking out with this, you can find the link to the playlist in my Instagram bio. But Miles and I were thinking, right, that down the line, maybe we'd start asking show guests time to time to recommend a few tracks that we'll add here and there. But it seemed only right that since we've already discussed Phil's musical taste, we let him throw down some choices. And
did he ever.
Man, can you learn a lot from having somebody create a Spotify playlist for you. And Phil was all over the place, right? From Wilco to Kanye West to Steely Dan.
Don't forget Heart.
Heart, there was some Heart in it. It was eclectic, and I liked that. And Miles, so we whittled it down to three selections of Phil's that are now officially in the Bent playlist. The first one being the White Stripes, Girl, You Have No Faith in Medicine. We both agreed on that one. I'm actually a White Stripes fan. I've always liked the White Stripes. And kudos to Phil. He didn't select really one hit. They were all B-sides, you know what I mean? And I appreciate that. I like that. Now, you chose, this was your pick, Run the Jewels, Goonies vs. E.T. I don't know anything about Run the Jewels.
Oh, come on. Killer Mike? You gotta love it. Anyway, yes. That's some classic conscious Atlanta hip-hop right there.
So finally, we went with Mexican Wine by Fountains of Wayne. That was my choice. And I selected
I don't know about that.
You're not a Fountains of Wayne guy, but I was a fan of their first album. They had a song called Sink to the Bottom. I want to sink to the bottom. And I rocked out to that, right, when I was a wee lad. And the first time I ever heard it was when they played it live on the Jenny McCarthy Show.
Oh,
do you remember the Jenny McCarthy Show, dude?
Sadly, I do. Yes.
It was awful, but that is where I discovered Fountains of Wayne. So anyway, if you hear those tracks pop up, you now know they are from Phil, who, upon being asked to contribute, said, and this is a direct Phil quote, "This is probably the least consequential thing I've done at Meat Eater, and I've never felt more pressure." So,
damn right you should.
The pressure is now off, Phil. You've done good. Your songs are in. The pressure is now on Miles, as it is your leadoff for news this week. Hit me.
All right. Okay. Pressure's on. See how I do. My first one's going to come. This comes from my original home state, where the Board of Land and Natural Resources is clearly not messing around. Mm. All right. Do not mess around in Hawaii, and you'll hear about this. This will make sense in a second. So last month, they issued the largest fine in state history for an aquatic resource violation, a $633,840 fine was issued to a Hilo man who dumped ant poison into Pahehehe stream in order to kill and collect huge quantities of Tahitian prawns for illegal sale.
I didn't get the stream name. Can you tell me the stream name again?
Pahehehe is the stream.
Okay, got it.
There you go. You got it? Did you get the, you get the accent
yes,
marks
I took
in
a note. Yes, I did.
Tahitian prawns are not native to Hawaii. Despite their misleading name, the species is found throughout East Africa, the Indian Ocean, and Indonesia, and then over into the Marquesas Islands. Hawaii state workers introduced Tahitian prawns into two streams on two separate islands, Molokai and Oahu, in 1956. 15 years later, the prawns were found in 42 different streams on every single Hawaiian island.
Wow. Ooh.
And though humans are responsible for the original introduction, the spread and proliferation occurred without any help. Because after hatching, Tahitian prawn larvae wash out to sea, where they spend a month growing and molting. And just before reaching maturity, the young prawns seek out whatever fresh water source they can find and make their way upstream, where they spend the remainder of their lives. And this life cycle makes them exceptional colonizers. And that's how they got everywhere.
Fascinating. So it's not like steelhead that go to the same streams.
No.
Like they'll just find the closest fresh water.
They just spread out. Yep, exactly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Right? And so they've been common residents of most freshwater systems in Hawaii since the 70s. And they're considered invasive, as they may compete with native shrimp and prawns, but their impacts have not been closely studied. So no one's sure how bad of a deal they are. And since they've been around for 50 years and everything hasn't collapsed, they kind of sort of like they're not that bad. But
right.
Harvest is allowed. And the Department of Land and Natural Resources has no bag limits on Tahitian prawns. You can take as many as you want. Common and legal methods of take include nets, spears, and spotlights. But dumping a bottle of poison into the water and then scooping up all the dead prawns as they float downstream is both illegal and incredibly destructive. Unfortunately, this practice seems like it's starting to become common, or at least common enough to draw significant attention and resources from the Hawaii DLNR. Because people like prawns, right? Like, prawns are good.
Yeah, man, throw on the grill. Love it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the legal methods of prawn hunting can yield, seems like from what I can tell, can yield like a big meal in a few hours of collection. You can get a couple dozen. But poachers can just dump a bottle of ant poison in a stream and get like 50 to 100 pounds or more in minutes. And then they take those fresh prawns and they sell them on the roadside and they make quick cash. Poisons like that kill indiscriminately and they have long-lasting negative impacts. According to state biologist Troy Sakihara, the illegal and unethical use of these pesticides in streams have shown to cause extremely damaging and long-lasting effects into all aquatic stream animals, native and non-native. These pesticides are highly toxic to all aquatic animals and result in extensive recovery time, particularly for native and endemic stream life. Typically, non-native and invasive species are the first to repopulate these impacted areas. Therefore, these types of activities can severely alter the natural biological conditions and overall health of the stream ecosystem. So real bad is what he's saying.
Yeah.
And beyond decimating the stream life, this practice is also dangerous for the people who consume the poison shellfish, right?
That's like you're just
buying prawns off the side of the road. It's full of ant poison. You don't know.
Yep.
So all this is to say that cracking down on this practice has become a high priority for the Hawaii DLNR. Last July, enforcement officer Edwin Shishido got an anonymous tip about one such incident. Shishido knew that he had an opportunity to make an impact, and so he spent the next 2 months building this case. He partnered with the Division of Aquatic Resources and the Department of Agriculture to collect water, soil, and prawn samples, all of which tested positive for benethrin, a toxin commonly found in commercial insect poisons. He tracked down eyewitnesses, and like he just spent a ton of time on this. He was ultimately successful in prosecuting the offender, whose actions resulted in the death of approximately 6,250 Tahitian prawns, in addition to who knows how much other aquatic wildlife.
Sure.
The guy got fined $1,000 per dead prawn, $200 for unlawful use of poisonous substances, plus another $8,640 to pay for the overtime that Officer Shishido and the other staff put into the case. The chair of the Hawaii Board of Natural Resources said at sentencing, "This very significant fine lets illegal fishers know that we take these matters very, very seriously. Responsible citizens acting as witnesses, and our officers are watching streams closely. And if you're engaged in these types of activities, eventually the law will catch up with you. This kind of illegal and extremely harmful fishing behavior, collecting prawns in streams using poison, is unacceptable, and we will enforce it at every turn." And I wish all poaching and wildlife cases were prosecuted this way.
Yeah.
Right? Because so often the story ends with the offender, like there's this whole thing and then the offender gets a nominal sanction or like a little fine. And I think that ends up doing far more harm than good, because the message from those cases is it's not that big a deal. That
right.
breaking fish and wildlife laws is really not that big a deal, so people keep doing it. If on the other hand, conservation officers are allowed and encouraged to prioritize catching offenders and hit them with big fines like this that also include the cost of overtime that all the people who caught them put into it, I think that might actually make people think twice. So I'm shouting out, I'm applauding Hawaii DLNR and especially Officer Shishido for this one. I think this is a job really well done.
Dude, I think it's amazing. And man, there's going to be a lot of connections between stories today. We've done some things in similar veins. And I completely agree. The thing is, like, the fine is what it is. Dude's got to pay it. And I mean, you know, sometimes you're dealing with people in these cases that don't have a ton of money. And it's like, well, you can lay that fine on a guy. It doesn't mean that the state's going to get all that money out of it. That's the deal. You know, and there's actually similarities here on the mainland. I feel like we've talked about it in this show at one point, but I had a good buddy who was a veteran guide on the Salmon River out here. And back in the Wild West days of poaching, that wasn't uncommon to have these salmon run up these little side tribs, and dude would dump a 10-gallon bucket of bleach in, and the other dude would stand at the bottom with a pitchfork.
Really?
Like, that happened, like, in New York State. Yeah. Yeah, like, that was a thing that people used to do. So the idea of poisoning a run like that to get what you need is it happens elsewhere, and that's the same deal. So then you're selling these salmon that, like, smell like bleach and their gills are white, and it's like, who wants to friggin' eat that? I will say, though, I know those prawns are invasive, but I've seen stuff on TV, like the legit guys that do it with the flashlights and the real small spear gun. It's like a little, like, needle dart. Uh-huh. I think it's cool as hell. Like, so I would like to try that.
No, you know? The only reason I haven't done it is because I grew up on Oahu, and I know that there are clean streams on Oahu where you can do this and feel comfortable about it. I don't know which ones they are. Like, the streams I grew up in, you don't want to eat out of those.
Right, right. And that's the other thing with all this poisoning. It's like, now if you want to do it on the up and up, how do you know which one hasn't been ant poisoned to death, you know?
Well, if there are prawns living in it, you're probably pretty safe. From what everything I read, it just wipes them out.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing, too, I appreciate ingenuity in terms of, like, getting legal meals or harvesting more crabs or whatever it may be. But, like, is this the only way? You would think, like, why isn't one of the old-timers, like, hooked up a car battery and shocked them or something? Like, can't we figure something out like that? We have to poison the entire stream? Like, my grandpa used to dig worms with a car battery and two electrodes, stick them in the ground, buzz them up come the worms. I'm like, that's ingenuity. You know what I mean? We're not harming anything.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm with you. I think it's a really cool way of harvesting food. And next time I'm on a neighbor island with cleaner water, I'm definitely going to do this, because I think that'd be a lot of fun.
I think it looks awesome. And you've given me the simplest transition, because we're going from invasives to invasives. This is a cool story, though it's a bit complex. I'm going to do my best to break it down in an orderly fashion here. But it comes from Hakai Magazine, which is great. We hit them a lot.
Magazine.
That's a really good magazine. Yeah. We highly recommend it. Excellent writing. And it centers around the bloodworm trade. And I realize that bloodworms are not exactly a ubiquitous bait. They're actually a very niche bait used in saltwater. But if you're a Northeasterner like me from the Mid-Atlantic, you probably understand their importance. So bloodworms are these big, ugly, mean-ass sea worms. They can be really long. They can be a foot long. They have legs that run down the side. It looks like a blood-red fringe. And while you can use them for a wide variety of saltwater species, they are most commonly used, at least where I live, for stripers and white perch, particularly in the early season when the resident bass are just waking up, because we have these fish in the back bays. They're not chasing bait all over. The water's cold, so they feed on the sand flats and the mud flats, and bloodworms are a choice bait. Very important. Now, these worms are primarily harvested in Maine and the Canadian Maritimes, and believe it or not, they are one of Maine's most valuable commercial fisheries. And according to the story, yes, in 2019, the worm trade in Maine was valued at north of $6 million total. And what's so cool about it is the deep tradition tied to this worm harvest. They have to be dug by hand. You cannot use automated machinery, right? You still can't dig for these worms on Sundays in Maine. And while this number has shrunk, it's estimated that there's still about 750 Mainers that dig worms at least part-time for supplemental income. And nowadays, the going rate for like a really big choice worm is about 60 cents per worm. Now, because these live worms, you know, don't live super long, this trade is all based around speed to market. Worms are dug, packed, and overnighted in most cases to bait shops across the country, which is why a dozen of the damn things is so expensive. They are an insanely expensive bait. Especially
what are we talking for a dozen?
Oh, man. You're going to put me on the spot. It's been so long since it's more than 10 bucks a dozen. Maybe even up around 15 bucks a dozen now.
I mean, it would have to be if the diggers are getting 60 cents and then they got to get overnighted and the store's got to make profit on top of that.
Exactly, right? If you put all those factors together, plus now the story is saying supply and demand because of the pandemic pushing more people to fish, they can't keep up. And I know there was a bloodworm shortage around here this past spring. You can only dig so many by hand. And truth be told, I only ever used them when I knew they'd be critical, right? Like we're doing this, we need to have bloodworms or we're not going to be successful. It's not something I've used much. You can catch fluke on them, sea bass, but they're just so damn expensive that I've rarely ever done that. Now, when you buy these worms, they come packed in seaweed, and it's a relatively common brown algae simply called wormweed. And to cut to the chase here, right, Amy Fowler, a marine biologist with the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, has been studying this wormweed for years. This started in 2011. She's taken samples from bait shops, from suppliers, and it turns out that it's a major contributor to introducing invasive species to other bodies of water. And this wormweed that these worms come packed in is filled with microorganisms. And the most critical are periwinkle snails and green crabs. And she believes those particular species ended up in several places that they should not be as a direct result of the bait trade. Furthermore, the wormweed itself can take hold and has done so in areas of both Chesapeake and San Francisco Bay because these main worms are shipped all the way across the country. Right? Because what happens, right? You finish with your worms, it's seaweed. You throw it in the water. Yeah. Right, you don't think anything of it. Now, I could go on and on about the invasives within the wormweed, but that's really not the most interesting part of the story. What's fascinating is that it's been proven that shipping bloodworms in wormweed provides no benefit. It doesn't make them live longer. They don't eat it. Right, it just acts like this natural moist packing peanut material. But distributors have skipped the weed in overnight shipments to Europe just to reduce weight. Just letting the worms roll around in styrofoam containers, and they survive just fine. Though it's kind of a day late and a buck short, California outlawed the importation of wormweed, and guess what? The worms headed there are now packed in wet cardboard strips or newspaper, and they do just fine. So it seems the simple solution is just stop packing the worms in wormweed, except the harvesting of the weed goes hand in hand with the traditional style of bloodworm harvesting in Maine. Like one guy who just harvests wormweed in this story says he gets about $7 a bag and can make $800 on a good low tide. Just collecting the weed for the worms to be packed in, right?
The weed that doesn't actually serve any benefit.
It serves no benefit. It serves really no benefit. A lot of the bait distributors in Maine are basically saying, like, they're like, Fowler is passing on this information. She's talking to these guys. And a lot of them are just basically saying, like, yeah, sorry. This is how we've been doing it for decades. And I'm not going to risk putting anyone out of work, meaning the weed harvesters, by changing my ways. So even though Fowler suggests that while it may hurt the finances of a select group of Mainers, these weed collectors, the bait distributors would actually save money in the long run by switching to a different packing material or skipping it altogether. She also says if you simply rinsed all the wormweed in fresh water before packing, it would get rid of a lot of these clinger-oners. But there's one distributor interviewed in the piece that says, rinsing all the weed, that's just too onerous, time-consuming, and contends that the solution is educating anglers that buy worms not to discard the wormweed in the water. So to put the full responsibility on the buyer of the bloodworm.
Oh, I could not disagree with that more.
Yeah. To me, it's plain as day.
That's infuriating.
And like I said, I've used bloodworms. It's not something I buy a ton of, but as long as I can remember, you buy bloodworms, they come in seaweed. Never thought anything of it. I threw that seaweed in the water. Never gave it a thought. You know, it's organic. Fowler was even saying in this piece, like, a lot of times when you're trying to pinpoint where certain invasives are coming from, it takes so long to find the source. Like, there's so much work put into the exact way that this thing got from here to here. And she's like, this one's plain as day. Like, we could track it. Like, these are all places that have this high use of bloodworms, and the bloodworms are packed in this seaweed that gets discarded. But it just sounds like tradition's too strong. Nobody wants to listen. It's just like, nah, we're gonna do that. That's what we do.
Oh, that is maddening. Like, I wish that everyone could see my face right now, because it's just like scrunched up in frustration.
Yeah.
Because this is not a hard, as you were saying, this is not a hard problem to solve.
It's not. It's not. And there is one, like, I sort of see a parallel, believe it or not. You know, you have these old timey worm harvesting operations that have worked with, you know, this guy and that guy to collect all their weed for so long. I sort of see a parallel. I think New Jersey and Oregon are the last two states where it's illegal to pump your own gas. An attendant has to do that for you. And, like, for many, many years, it's like, can we just, like, save money and, like, we are happy to pump our own gas? But it's like, yeah. But just simply killing that would put so many people out of work. So I sort of see the loyalty and the tradition there, and not wanting their buddies and the people they've worked with forever to be out of a weed harvesting job.
That analogy doesn't work for me, because there is no downside other than a slightly higher cost per gallon of fuel.
Yeah.
And this one you're talking about, we're transporting invasive species all over the country and the world. And all we have to do is stop doing this. It confers zero benefit other than a job. Like, that to me is the definition of creating a job that is detrimental and has no value.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to hate on the weed harvesters out there. This is not a personal attack at any of you, but I think maybe you want to start getting into digging worms. Perhaps that might be the way that you could transition. Similar activity, it seems.
Did I tell you what? It is a nasty job, man. This is like a low tide window. You are, you know, balls deep in muck. Like, it is hard work. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Here's the other thing I'm going to say. By putting this on, let's say that the onus is on anglers, right? Well, that's not actually going to fall on anglers, because the only way this really works is if now every other state where bloodworms are used for fishing has to create a regulation whereby if you have bloodworm weed, you cannot dispose of it. And that's just another thing that wardens have to now use their time looking out for, which they don't have the time or the resource to do, and they don't want to do. And that to me is obnoxious when it could have been handled at the source. And that helps me kind of like continue my theme of the week, which is calling out game and wildlife enforcement officers in a positive light. Cause these are men and women who take a lot of shit.
Oftentimes
unfairly, and they rarely get credit for all the good work that they do, right? Like, they don't want to police your worm weed. They don't want to do that, but they'll have to, perhaps, even though it could have been solved elsewhere in the supply chain, right? And I'm going to start this one. The actual story here is short and kind of dumb, but I like it anyway. But I'm going to start it off with a story of my own. So the first time my wife and I took our son out on our boat, it was a beautiful June weekend a couple years ago. The kid was 7 months old. We met up with some friends and their kids. We all launched our boat at this busy river access point on the Madison. And our friends were out ahead just a little bit. And I just eased our 16-foot drift boat out of the current when I saw a warden waving me back over to the bank. And, you know, I complied immediately, as I always do. And I was not concerned, right? I've talked to lots of wardens. I've been checked many times.
Sure.
I pulled up next to the guy. Like, I got all my paperwork. I got all my safety equipment. I'm legit. No problem. What do you need to see? But then he looks at me and he says, sir, do you have a life jacket for that child? And I was just totally thrown, because I didn't. The kid, the kid wasn't even crawling yet. So the idea of him needing a life jacket, it simply hadn't crossed my mind, which is stupid, because I knew the law, right? Like, I knew that all kids 12 and under have to wear a PFD at all times. I had to do that when I was guiding, but I never thought about it with an infant who couldn't get away. I just didn't think right. about it, right? So, like, I mean, blame
just
it
put
on
him
a
on
year.
The bow. He's not
right,
going anywhere.
He's fine. I blame it on a year and a half of sleep deprivation, whatever. But I was utterly unprepared. And it being this beautiful weekend day, right? The ramp is super crowded. There are people everywhere. And the officer was understanding, but like, he kind of just, he's like, he was explaining, like, God, I'm sorry, man, but like, I have to pay attention to this. It's something that we're focusing on this year, particularly on this river, is making sure kids are safe because we've had some issues, and which I get, right? So he's like, I can't just look the other way on this. And what he could have done was he could have told us, all right, I'm sorry, but you guys are out of here. You don't have a life jacket for that kid. Pull the boat back up, put it on the trailer, which would have been a really lame way to end my son's first ever float trip. It would have been a real disappointing day. And I would have been upset. My wife would have been, everybody would have been upset. But
he'd have gotten over it though, if nothing else.
He would have moved right on to other things, but that's not what he did. And that's where I have to give
him
credit.
Your son. He wouldn't have remembered.
Oh, no, he wouldn't have cared at all. No, he would have been like, feed me and let me sleep and scream at you. But the officer didn't do that, right? So instead, he went back to his truck and he pulled out an infant life jacket of his own and loaned it to my son so that we could legally complete our float. I'll say he did also issue me a citation, but I chalked that up to the price of stupidity on my part. Like, I deserved that. The point is that, like, these aren't the stories that usually get told, right? Mm-hmm. The ones where wildlife officers go out of their way to help people. It's you usually hear the other ones. And in this case, I was breaking the law, and that dude had every right to just pull us off the river and go about his day. But he chose to loan us some of his personal property so that we could have fun and we could do what we're doing. And that's exactly what he did. And so that, I thought of that because I just read this other story from the local news on Lake Tuscaloosa in Alabama from last weekend. Tyler Cunningham took his girlfriend, Mackenzie Boyd, out on his bass boat. And he told her that he wanted to sneak in a little bit of fishing before they had to head out to a friend's house for a dinner party. So they hit the water dressed in their Sunday best, like fully ducked out to go bass fishing.
Okay.
All of a sudden, middle of the lake, Cunningham cuts the outboard, gets down on one knee, pulls out a rig and proposes to Boyd, who's like... Ugh. Totally surprised. I love your response there. Yeah. I give the dude credit because he actually pulled off the surprise part. And you know, she accepts, everybody's happy, blah, blah, blah. It's a touching moment, Sir Melly.
Okay.
But then on the way back to the ramp, the couple gets detained by state wildlife officers because they don't have life jackets or a fire extinguisher on board. Now, similarly, by law, the officers could have issued a couple citations and that would have been the end of this story, but they didn't. They did it differently. They let the couple off with a warning, which I think is a nice thing to do for a young couple who's probably broke. I know I was a young couple, but then they also used this event as an opportunity to do a little PR work. And this is what I think was pretty smart. The officers took photos with the couple and then they put up a Facebook post that I got to say is kind of clever. And so here's how it read, quote, "Quite an eventful boat ride on Lake Tuscaloosa for Mackenzie L. Boyd, who was first detained with a request for her hand in marriage, and then once again with requests for licenses and registration. Officers Stanley and Holloway congratulate Mackenzie and her beau, Tyler Cunningham, and remind them that the secret to a long and successful life together includes life jackets and accessible fire extinguishers." Okay. I know this is kind of a cheesy story, and I get that.
No, I have something to say. If you don't say it first,
I want to give both the officers involved and the Alabama Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries Division a lot of credit for how they handled this. Because as we've already said, as I've mentioned, wardens generally have difficult, thankless jobs. And while there are always exceptions, the vast majority of the wardens that I've ever dealt with have been courteous and polite and professional.
Yep,
and
me too.
You may get annoyed at getting checked or getting a citation for doing something accidental or stupid. I get that. But you got to remember that these are men and women. Their primary responsibility is to protect the fish and wildlife that we all really care about. And think about the sum total. Think about the good versus harm. And think about how often, like, they have to deal with people being jerks to them.
Yes.
and then take a step back and recognize that when they have these moments to like throw some levity in the situation, I think that is incredibly valuable, and I love when they do it, and I thought that was very well handled.
Here's what I will say, which just really goes back to the couple, right? I don't know, dude. I've had a lot of boats. I have boats now. The life jackets are always in the boat.
It's real easy.
Like, they don't ever come out of the boat. The fire extinguisher doesn't come out of the boat. Like, everything is always in the boat. Like, that's like common sense to me. So when I hear people on larger boats that get hit for having no life jacket, I'm like, what do you take your life jackets on and off the boat every single, even if you wear, right? Like, even if you wear the suspenders type, the comfortable mm-hmm. ones.
Yeah.
I still have the shitty orange ones jammed in there to be up to code in case I forget the suspenders. So you're like, you're always legal. I don't understand that.
I don't understand that either. Yeah. same on my boat. I'm with you.
Well, so I'm going to close here with one that no levity from Fish and Game officials was warranted for this one, because it's pretty ugly. And there's really not a great punchline other than, like, we're going to crunch some numbers here, and you're going to be like, what, right? So this one comes from Michigan's MLive.com. Headline, two Michigan men fined $8,500 for poaching hundreds of walleye, panfish, and perch, right? Now, it's not that difficult to dig up a poaching story.
We're really on theme this week.
We're all connected here. We are one. We are locked in. But I was going to say, it's not really that hard to find a poaching story on the local outdoor police blotter somewhere. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, there's always somebody doing something. But this one's pretty over the top. So this is from the story. In a single day in March, Stanley Garbaz Jr., 68 years old, of Caseville, and Bruce Warren, 53, of Pigeon, were allegedly over the perch daily catch limit by 60 fish. Authorities also found hundreds more walleye, panfish, and perch in Garbaz's freezer. The case began in March when the Department of Natural Resources received a tip on its report all poaching hotline. So there you go. If you ever scoffed at those and like don't think you should call. Okay, because here's an example of where that worked. Advising that Garbaz was at his residence in possession of a few hundred perch. DNR Conservation Officer Josh Wright proceeded to the home and called the Huron County Sheriff's Office for assistance. Deputy Joshua Loss arrived first and confirmed that there was, quote, a lot, end quote, of perch being filleted. When Wright arrived, he received permission to count the fish that had been caught that day and were being processed by Garbaz and Warren. He counted 170. They were each over the daily catch limit by 60 perch. Wright then found an additional 85 bags of frozen fish in four freezers at Garbaz's residence. The fillets were thawed and counted. Once everything was thawed and counted, it turned out dude was over his possession limit by 35 walleye, 245 panfish, and 393 perch.
My God.
So this is my assessment. Short story, again, like there's no quotes from these guys or anything, but on top of their fine, the combined fine of $8,500, naturally, these men also face the loss of their licenses, you know, forever. but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, similar to my worry about the prawn deal, the loss of a fishing license will not necessarily stop these guys from fishing because – like, these violations to me are so egregious. I'm guessing that these two old timers basically give zero shits. Like, if you're one or two over the limit and try to be sneaky and you got caught, that's one thing. But if you're willing to go 393 perch over the limit, I'm betting you don't actually care about the rules. You have not read the annual compendium. You probably never will. And I don't really think if, like, you can't get a license, you're not going to go out on the lake at night or do what you're going to do. Just my assessment. Great bust. Like, good on them for busting this one. And again, similar to the Hawaii story, I mean, that's a hefty fine. They're really trying to get after these dudes, but I always question, will it really matter in the end?
I mean, it is. It is a hefty fine, but not compared to the $634,000.
No.
But
if Phil is gauging just on fines, you have won.
I totally
clearly.
Won. Yes. I'm gonna be quick here. I don't understand why anybody, like, I get eating fish, I get harvesting fish, having that many fish, particularly freshwater fish in your freezer, doesn't make that much sense to me.
Yeah.
There's something going on there that I can't wrap my head around. I try to be compassionate about like these people whose stories come up, but this one I just struggle with. And to your other point, yeah, all the fines here may not ever get paid. These people may not be able to, but I do think that having a story that puts the word out there, that can dissuade other people from making similar choices. And that's where, particularly with the prawn story, like, oh shit, they can come after me for $500,000. Probably not worth it to poison some prawns tonight. But that you're probably right. These individuals likely can't pay these fines and likely won't change their behavior. But hopefully it changes the behavior of many others who might otherwise make similar stupid choices. That's my hope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's always hard you never really can seem to find the follow-up to these kinds of stories. Like, you read them and you read, you know, the fines, but then there's never anything about whether dude actually ended up paying them. So
yeah,
we may never know. I don't know. We'll keep an eye out. Phil's got a lot to ponder here. I think we did a good job, like you said, of staying just very just totally connected. So difficult job for Phil, our guest DJ of the week. We're going to hear from him, and then we're going to do a little covering water with a tarpon legend. We'll go full salty.
Miles, I do not judge based on which one of your subjects procured the largest fine. I rate under three categories: spunk, sizzle, and SPF. And I think within those parameters, the winner is obvious. Joe Cermelli, congratulations. Just for a glimpse behind the scenes, I sent Joe and Miles a big list of songs to choose from, and I did not hear a single word back. So I just assumed that they probably saw the Buddy Rich Big Band on there and regretted asking me to contribute, and we're just going to pretend that it never happened. But no, thanks for including my songs, guys. Appreciate it. I can't wait to see what selections River Horse makes.
I'm going in. Cover me, Porkins.
I can hold it.
Pull on!
No, I'm all right. Pull on!
Wasting his valuable time with us today, we have infamous tarpon guide and photographer David Mangum. What's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing? Good. Infamous, huh? Yeah. We'll see.
Well, so I that was intentional, man. I used infamous to describe you because you've I don't know if you've earned or cultivated this kind of reputation, right? Like,
gosh,
the
I
rumor
don't know.
Mill, the rumor mill has it that you can be abrasive, maybe. On the water? Is that legit? Did you like really deserve that, or is it just really good brand marketing?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends whether you mean to the boats that are near me or to the people on my boat. So the answers would be different. But no, you know, I think when I was younger, I was a little more abrasive, but in my old age, I've softened up, let's say. How's that work?
I like that. I think we all mellow with age. I know I do.
Yeah, a little bit.
We've asked you here to do this, I guess you'd call it our version of an interview, but you know, instead of like conducting a well thought out proper interview, we just blurt out a bunch of shit and see what you come back with. So here's how it's going to work. Joe's going to put 2 minutes on the clock, and then he and I are going to like pepper you with rapid fire questions. Goal is to get through as many of these as we can in 2 minutes, which means you can't really think about it. You just got to react. It's I think I'd describe it as like a verbal Rorschach test.
First thing that comes to your head, just say it.
Exactly.
Got it.
But in the spirit of fairness, we will give you 1 minute at the end to like expand and elaborate on whichever answer you think is most interesting or stupid. Sound good?
Okay. Sure.
All right. Joe, you ready?
And clock is starting now.
Roughly how many clients have you made cry in your career?
Zero.
Nice. Worst place you've ever been hooked?
Eyelid.
Ooh.
One sentence that describes how you feel about spoon flies.
God, I don't even know a sentence. Garbagey.
Finish the sentence. I cringe whenever a client tells me they've
got high expectations.
Yes.
There you go.
The words that come out of your mouth when you see someone trout set on a tarpon.
Bleep, 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 bleep.
What's the greatest tarpon destination outside of the U.S.?
I'm going to have to go Guinea-Bissau.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, far flung.
Florida man stories, funny or annoying?
Oh, God, both.
Pivotal point in a tarpon fight people screw up most often.
Boat side, just too much bend in the rod.
Okay.
Greatest angler of all time.
Zane Grey.
Ooh, Saved by the Bell or Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
Fresh Prince.
Yeah, nice.
Black Flag, No Effects, or Blink 182?
Black Flag.
Oh, excellent. Yep. Name a bucket list species you haven't checked off your list yet.
I'm going to have to go with Black Marlin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Greatest fly ever invented.
Spoon fly. No, kidding. maybe the toad. Gary Merriman's toad.
Okay, and we have time for one last question here. Chasing line class records, cool or lame?
Somewhere in between. Depends. There's a lot to do. There's a lot you have to answer with that question, but somewhere in between. It all depends on the person chasing.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, now you got your 1 minute to elaborate if that's the one you want to go on. You can pick any. Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of the difference between folks that chase line class records, some folks that have been angling their whole life and have caught everything and they're trying to make it more challenging, they don't care if they catch that fish because they've already caught tons of them. So they challenge themselves by trying to do some line class records. If you're doing line class records to try to make a big name for yourself and you're starting out angling and you start out doing it, it's garbage.
We recently reviewed the Monty Burke Lords of the Fly book that kind of goes through that whole culture. I don't know if you've read it, man, but it's a really good one.
I have.
I figured since you were in there.
So to each his own, I think is my feeling on it. I think in some ways it's great. Chase the line class records. In some ways, I don't know. I'm hot and cold on it, but I think I'm warming up to it a little more after, the book and kind of looking into the hearts of some of those people to do it. So
Dave, we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, man, and coming on here. We hope to talk to you again soon. So I've never actually hung out with Dave, but we have quite a few mutual friends, but I've never had a beer with the guy. Mm-hmm. He's an icon in the saltwater fly fishing world. But he definitely has that reputation, like a long-standing reputation of being a hard ass, right?
Oh, dude. I know people who fished with him back in the day that were like scared. They were a little bit scared, and I don't personally know him either. But supposedly, he's this super amped up hothead.
Yeah,
but that was not the guy who showed up for our interview.
No.
I don't know. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if he's just mellowed out as he's gotten a little older, or he was just in a chill mode. Because we caught him, in the off season, not between crazy tarpon trips, or if he's just trying to soften his public image, which is also a possibility. But he was not at all like the intimidating aggro dude that he's been made out to be.
No, enjoyable. I feel like he's hired a PR consultant or something, someone to polish him up. You got an interview come up? Okay, here's what you got to do: take three Valium, wash it down with this. I don't know. He didn't show up anyway as the image that he's been built up to be. And I don't know if I'm disappointed or if I was relieved about that. I was kind of ready for this edgy interview that was combative, and it just wasn't like that at all. It was kind of tame, actually.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's different when he hits the water, which would mean that he has something in common with the classic fly you're going to tell us about in this week's End of the Line, which also happens to be my favorite dry fly.
Fishy, 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 fishy!
Well, that's not loud enough, Bert.
One mid-March, years ago, a former fishing buddy and I skipped town for a few rain-soaked days. The trip turned into an exercise in cognitive dissonance. Misery amid euphoria. 3 days of steady downpour with temps that never crept above the low 40s. The air and water were nearly indistinguishable, being about the same temperature and saturation level. We set up camp in the rain, rendering our shelters wet from the start and leaving us no escape, no warm, cozy respite. So we just stayed on the river from daylight to dusk because, though our bodies may have been damp and cold, We experienced 3 days of the most spectacular trout fishing either of us had ever seen, before or since. Insects emerged from the water in sheets, creating a near mirror image of the falling rain. And just about every trout settled at the surface with their mouths wide. The gray light and steady drizzle made them far less spooky than usual on this particular tailwater. And since the weather was more southeast Alaska than Fort Lauderdale, the spring break crowds were absent. We didn't quite have the place to ourselves, but with hoods up and eyes focused, we hardly saw another soul. The first morning, we set up in a long slick covered in feeding fish. Two different insects were hatching, tiny midges and just slightly larger slate-colored mayflies called betas. The fish seemed to be alternating between bugs, so I kept switching flies. One fish would be focused on midges, while the fish just below it only wanted mayflies. Meanwhile, my buddy, standing just downstream, remained consistently hooked up without ever retying. I finally broke down while shivering and trying to thread hair-thin mono into a minuscule hook eye. Again. Dude, what are you using? An Adams. Size 20, he replied, rod still bent. Kind of looks like a midge cluster, kind of looks like a betas. I dug into my box, tied on a size 20 Adams, and didn't change flies again for the rest of the trip, except when one got chewed beyond recognition or broken off by a big fish. If I could, I would rename the Adams the Gray Area. With a gray-dubbed body and some buggy hackle, it's the prototypical anything fly. You can find it in sizes that range from damn near invisible, like what we were fishing in that rainstorm hatch, to holy shit, is that a hummingbird? Depending on how it's tied, it can imitate midges, mayflies, caddis, even ants, and fool everything from the most naive backcountry opportunists to the most selective tailwater scrutinizers. The Adams was invented in Michigan in 1922. The story goes like this. Charles Adams, an attorney and avid fly angler who regularly traveled to Michigan to fish the famous Boardman River, found himself in a position familiar to almost anyone who trout fishes. He was on the Mayfield Pond one summer evening and found fish rising to some kind of insect that he could not identify or imitate. Now, Adams couldn't tie flies. He was your standard, relatively clueless, wealthy sport. So the next day, he went to local fly tyer Leonard Halliday and described, in broad and general terms, the confounding bug. Halliday lashed golden pheasant feathers to a size 14 hook to create the tail, coarsely dubbed the body with gray wool yarn, and then made oversized wings and hackle from rooster neck feathers. Halliday handed the creation to Adams, who fished it the following day and reported incredible success. Being a humble Midwestern fella, Halliday decided to name the fly not after himself, but the man who commissioned it. Tellingly, Adams' initial success on the new fly didn't come on the pond where the mystery hatch actually went down. Instead, he proved its effectiveness on the nearby Boardman River, where the insects would almost certainly have been different, which makes the perfect origin story for this fly that can imitate just about anything. Also fittingly, the modern Adams in your fly box or local fly bins doesn't include a single one of those original materials from Halliday's invention. Over the past 90 years, the fly has transformed. What was once a bushy, oversized, and frankly kind of sloppy-looking fly morphed into a relatively sleek and sparse profile as American fly tying evolved. Unlike modern fly marketing, where a tire swaps out a single material and then claims to have invented a whole new pattern, the Adams evolved steadily, but completely, without ever losing its name. It became a collaborative pastiche of American fly tying tradition as a whole, with dozens of different innovators adding their own flair to it over the decades without demanding any credit. First, the golden pheasant tail changed to brown or grizzly hackle fibers sometime in the mid-1930s. Next to go was the wool yarn body, which has a tendency to absorb water and cause the fly to sink, replaced by much more buoyant muskrat fur. Then, the wings and hackle shifted to an upright Catskill style. Eventually, the fly lost most of its original form. Today's Adams sports a calf tail or poly yarn parachute instead of hackle tip wings and a synthetic dubbed body. The only attribute it shares with the original is the color, gray, a generic stand-in that can pass for just about anything. The Adams is a perfect reminder that profile and presentation matter more than exact representation when it comes to fly fishing. Cut off the tail, pick out the dubbing a little, and it looks like a caddis. Keep it sleek, and it can imitate just about any mayfly on the planet, as long as you get the size right. Most of all, it's the perfect fly to use when you encounter a situation like the fly's namesake, Charles Adams, did on that Michigan pond in the early 20s. When fish are feeding on some kind of bug that you can't seem to identify, you don't need to text photos to some aquatic entomologist friend. Just grab an Adams of appropriate size and make a good cast.
So that is all we have in the fly bin for you guys this week. We hope that we didn't piss off any of our Fly Furious listeners or our glorious sponsors, 13 Fishing, who doesn't make fly rods, but does make badass rods of many other kinds. But if we did anger you, take a deep breath, find your center, get a grip on that tapered leader, and cut about a foot off the butt end. Seek inner clarity on the reasons why you are chasing those line class records in the first place, and reconnect with the whole family of flies named Adams.
Nice. Nice.
It's a mouthful.
It was a lot, but I liked the puns in that. And if you're struggling with your feelings about fly fishing or this episode, or have any questions that we might be able to help with, drop us a line. Email us at bent@themeateater.com. Also, I just got to say, all of you out there, you've been kind of slacking on the awkward photos and the bar nominations lately.
For shame.
Few and far between. We love those segments, and they don't exist without your help. So send us what you got. Help us out.
Yep.
Keep them going.
Yep. Please, please, please do. And don't forget to drop the Degenerate Angler and Bent Podcast hashtags on the gram for additional chances to win stickers from us.
And finally, keep in mind that most of us learn to fly fish on a neighborhood pond with a shitty second or third hand setup we bought cheap or stole from a family member. You don't need a trust fund and a frequent flyer account to have fun with the long rod. Give it a shot.